The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app.
Hanukkah light burns so bright.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got an awesome show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we're going to be interviewing Catherine Hickley, who wrote a book about something we reported back in 2012, one of those more weird stories. The book is called The Munich Art Hoard, Hitler's Dealer and His Secret Legacy. You may recall, they found this guy in Germany who had the 1,500 paintings stashed away that his father had given him, and these were like his babies, and he was like, you know, really this crazy person, and like, what has happened with that? So she wrote a whole book about it. Fascinating, fascinating. The portion of this week is Vayeshev. It's, you know, Joseph and his brothers. That's really cool stuff, way far out. We've got an awesome Hasidic story, of course, Jewish music of all kinds. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Secretary of State John Kerry in Jerusalem. They discussed the war against ISIS and the current Arab terror wave in Israel. State Department spokespeople have said the U.S. does not expect peace talks with the PA to resume anytime soon. We could put that in the duh category. Lawyers for Jonathan Pollard, who was released from prison last week, are suing the federal government to have the convicted spy's terms of probation eased. Currently, Pollard is in a dusk to dawn curfew. He has to be in his apartment at that time. He must wear an electronic ankle bracelet at all time, is not allowed to use the internet, and he's not allowed to leave New York. A rocket was launched from Gaza into a vacant area in southern Israel. What's so unusual about this, as this was a homemade rocket? And what's so unusual about that, as Hamas has been making its own rockets because Egypt has closed the border between Sinai and Gaza, and Hamas cannot get Iranian-made rockets. Here's one of those scratching-the-head type stories. The UN adopted 6 resolutions condemning Israel this week for not turning the Golan Heights back to Syria and for keeping Jerusalem as Israel's capital exclusive of their governments. Yeah, tell me how that makes sense. There has been no condemnation of the Syrians who are slaughtering Palestinians, by the way, at a greater rate than the Israelis are because the Israelis aren't slaughtering them. Anyway, in some other news, Panama signed a free trade agreement with Israel, its first with a Middle Eastern nation. Israel exports $25 million in goods to Panama last year and received $3 million in goods from Panama. I wonder if that included those cool straw hats. Anyway, but this is Curious George time. No, we'll probably talk about that next week. And finally, in the story that should really end all stories, you might want to remember these names. Lee Delnick, Bernice Diamond, Helen Greenspan, and Zelda King, aged 87 to 95, had their weekly Mahjong game interrupted by police who stopped them from playing in their condominium house in Florida on suspicion that the group was illegally gambling. The game was allowed to continue after they were arrested and booked, as Florida law allows gambling games involving less than $10. The foursome capped their winning at $4. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Marshall Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. We are on the air with Catherine Hickley. Has written a book called The Munich Art Hoard. This is, we've discussed this extensively in our news segments over the last couple of years or so. Somebody was found to have a hoard of art in there that's been stolen by the Nazis, and it made big headlines over here. So without further ado, how are you today, Catherine?
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay, so we have this story which was like incredulous enough that you have this old man, he's a hermit, he's a sociopath, maybe a misanthrope, whatever other adjective we would like to refer to this person, and he was sitting on, probably, you can correct me if I'm wrong, close to $1 billion or more than $1 billion worth of artwork.
Yes, I mean, that was the first figure that was bandied around. So it was certainly the reported number. It's probably a little bit of an overestimate, but, you know, certainly a collection worth several hundred million.
Yeah, what's a couple hundred million between friends? Yes. Okay. So.
And if you look at the quality of the art, it was extraordinary. I mean, we're talking about masterpieces by artists such as Chagall and Picasso and Monet and Manet, and then a lot of German expressionists like Max Beckmann and Otto Dix and Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, Paul Klee. These are all artists who today fetch millions and millions and millions when their works are sold at auction. So it was just an extraordinarily high quality collection.
Okay, let's go back. I mean, people are familiar with, it's been the subject of movies already. You have the story of the Monument Men. There's the Woman in Gold that was made into a movie, a book, and that people are all familiar with. But what, give us the backstory on this specific stuff. This is a cache that was found in the apartment of a Hildebrand Görlitz. So let's hear about the Görlitz story.
Well, it was actually the apartment of Cornelius Görlitz, who was the son of Hildebrand Görlitz. And Cornelius Görlitz was, as you said in your intro, was a recluse. He was someone who really didn't have very much contact with anyone at all. The only person he'd been close to in his adult life was his sister, who had died a couple of years ago. So he was really, really on his own. And what he was hoarding was a massive bequest from his father, Hildebrand Görlitz, who was an art dealer for the Nazis and who had acquired art for Hitler's planned museum in Linz, the Führermuseum, which he wanted to become this enormous center of culture in provincial Linz in Austria.
Mm-hmm. So he's an art dealer then. So he was an art dealer then before the war. So if he's dealing in art, so did he come by this art cache illegally?
Well, the legality is one thing. He came by a lot of it immorally, that much we can definitely say for sure. He bought art from Jews who were emigrating from Germany, who were escaping the Nazis, and he bought at very low prices and sold again at much higher prices. He also bought art that had been stolen from Jews by the Nazis that had already been looted. And some of the art in the collection fell into both of those categories. Not all of it by any stretch, but at the moment we still don't know how much because the provenance research on this whole collection hasn't been completed yet.
Okay, so let me ask you now. I know the importance of it, but let me ask you. So why is this a story? We have this saying that I know I heard when I was a kid, all's fair in love and war, and people lose things in war. There's, you know, pillaging and plundering and land gets transferred and what was Poland is now Russia, which was Germany, which is now France. I mean, so why does the fact that there are people don't have their artworks that they gave up to get out of the country, even a story, Catherine Hickley?
Well, first of all, we're not talking about wartime. We're talking about people who were persecuted and robbed as a pattern by the Nazis in peacetime. These were German citizens, and the Nazis came to their home and stole their possessions. Not only that, often these were people who had left the country to escape persecution at the hands of the Nazis, and ultimately death, as we know that, you know, that that 6 million people were killed in the Holocaust. Very many Jews didn't escape, and they lost their lives as a result. So the position is really very different from trophy art in wartime. The Nazis stole from their own citizens as part of a pattern of persecution against the Jews. And they didn't only steal art, they stole everything. They stole the furniture, they stole the candlesticks, they stole the cutlery, they stole the bedding. They took everything from the homes of Jews who had either left or been deported to camps. So the scandal is that these people haven't got their things back after all these years, that 75 years later, there are still people looking for possessions that belong to their families. And there are very many people in that situation. And this is what the story, I think, brought to the foreground, was that this was a terrible injustice conducted against the Jews, and one that actually could be resolved in some way, where the art could actually still be returned. No one can bring back the people who died in the Holocaust. That's impossible. No one can restore, you know, the position that Jews had in German society or the whole cultural identity, but they can give them back their artworks and their possessions. And the fact that that hadn't happened all these decades after the end of the Second World War was something that I think shocked people.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of that has to do with the fact that those people just weren't around anymore, correct?
Well, I mean, if you look at the numbers, about half of the Jews in Germany emigrated and about half were killed. Those who didn't emigrate were almost all killed in the death camps. Mm-hmm. So the fact is that many families did still have heirs surviving, people who had emigrated and who had managed to find a new start somewhere else. But I think that in so many cases, people, you know, after the war, they were traumatized by what had happened. It took a very long time for claimants to start looking for the possessions. The first thing was to start a life in a new country. And in many cases, they weren't really looking. Or if they were looking, the entire restitution processes that were in place in Europe after the Second World War were not necessarily very understanding. They were quite cold and callous and bureaucratic. And it was extremely difficult to reclaim property immediately after the war. Some people succeeded. It did happen. But in many cases, it was only really after the fall of the Berlin Wall and in the 1990s that there was even a chance to pursue old possessions, particularly if they happened to be in Eastern Europe. In East Germany, for example, there was a policy of non-restitution completely to Jewish owners and Jewish collectors of art. So it was only after 1989 that they even had a hope of getting their possessions back.
Okay, let's talk. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Catherine Hickley. She's written a book, The Munich Art Hoard, Hitler's Dealer and His Secret Legacy, based on this real account, and it was brought to light through a series of news items that came through. So tell us, please, if you could, who was this Cornelius Gurlitt? Was he a reputable art dealer who went bad? Was he always a bad guy? What was it? To me, it seems like a person, if I have an opportunity to buy something cheap and sell it more expensive, well, that's called business. So tell us about this gentleman.
Hildebrand Gurlitt.
Yes.
Yeah, Hildebrand Gurlitt was, he was born into a very wealthy Dresden family, and he was himself a quarter Jewish. He had a Jewish grandmother. And he grew up, his father was a champion of Baroque architecture in Dresden, which is one of the most beautiful proponents of that kind of architecture. And he spent much of his life, he was an advisor to the King of Saxony, and he was a very highly respected scholar, the father of Hildebrand Gurlitt. And Hildebrand Gurlitt grew up liking this much more modern art, the German expressionist art. So, for example, the art of the Brücker artists, Ernst Ludwig Kirchner and Max Peckstein and Karl Schmidt-Rottluff, who were all based in Dresden. And their art is difficult art, and it was perceived as such at that time. It was very... It was very, let's say, challenging, provocative art. And this is what he grew up loving and what he also wanted to advocate as a museum director. And he became a museum director at the age of 25, working for a museum in Zwickau, which is a small industrial town not far away from Dresden.
What year is that?
That was in 1925.
Okay, so we're in like the roaring 20s of Germany right now.
In the Weimar Republic, exactly.
Yes.
And he asked his friends at the Bauhaus to help him with the decor at the museum. He wanted to have the latest furniture, the trendiest paint colors. Everything had to be absolutely up to date. And he also bought the right kind of art for that era as well. So he invested a lot in buying modern art, so Max Peckstein and the other artists I mentioned, Käthe Kollwitz and others, the German expressionist artists. So the artists he loved were also the artists that the Nazis hated. And increasingly he came under pressure in this little provincial town of Zwickau, where the Nazis actually gained foot long before they took power in Germany as a whole. So in 1930, he actually lost his job as the director of the museum in Zwickau because of the kind of art that he was championing. And this was the art that the Nazis perceived as degenerate. So the modern German art that he loved was exactly the art that the Nazis hated. They equated this kind of art with Bolshevism, with disease, with degeneracy, with the Jews, with all of the things that they hated. And he lost his job as a result of exactly that. So then he got another job in Hamburg, and he managed to start again and to continue to promote the kind of art that he'd been promoting in Zwickau. So far from being cowed by his experiences there, he actually took courage from that. And he became the director of the Art Association in Hamburg. And for 2 years, he also put on a huge number of extremely daring exhibitions. One of the artists whom he exhibited there was Henry Moore, who's one of Britain's best-known sculptors now. But at that time, he was just 34, and no one knew who he was. And Hildebrand Gurlitt saw him and noticed that this was a brilliant new artist. But he lost that job too when the Nazis came to power. And his story was that he had sawn off the flagpole at the front of the gallery so that he didn't have to hang the swastika banner. And he was then really stuck because as a quarter Jew after 1933, he wasn't allowed to work for the state and he wasn't allowed to work as a journalist, which he'd done previously. So he became an art dealer and he set up on his own in Hamburg. And this is where he began to make the kind of compromises that led to the kind of ethical compromises, let's say, that led to the birth of this collection that we discovered rather recently. So he continued to daringly sell the degenerate art that the Nazis hated, but he also began buying from Jews who were desperate to leave the country, and he would buy at low prices and sell at higher prices. And he also began to work for Goebbels, for the propaganda ministry. The Nazis had seized all the art that they hated from museums across Germany. So they had taken 20,000 artworks across Germany, and they put on this exhibition in Munich known as the Degenerate Art Exhibition, to shame and condemn this modern art. And Hildebrand Gurlitt was, they then had this collection, this stash of 20,000 modern artworks, which they put in a wheat silo in Berlin that they didn't know what to do with. And there was talk of burning the whole lot in a propagandistic bonfire, rather in the way that had already happened with books. But luckily, commercial interests prevailed, and they decided that instead of doing that, they would sell this art abroad. And Hildebrand Gurlitt was one of four dealers who was selected to sell the degenerate art abroad.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't like it, but if you could make a buck on it, they were willing to do that.
Exactly. They needed the foreign currency to fund the war effort. It was about buying munitions, really, about buying armory for the Second World War. So Hildebrand Gurlitt was one of the people who actually helped them to make money for the war effort. And it continued from there because not long after that, Hitler decided that he wanted to set up this fantastic museum in Linz. And because of his contacts and because of the fact that he knew everyone and he knew the art so well and he knew the collectors and the dealers, Hildebrand Gurlitt was assigned to purchase art in occupied France for the Führer Museum, for this planned enormous museum that Hitler wanted to have in Linz. So again, it was a huge compromise. You know, this was a man who, on the face of it, was an anti-Nazi. He'd sawn the flagpole off the front of his gallery. He was a quarter Jewish. He kept very quiet about his Jewish grandmother while he was working for the Nazis. He really lived in fear that anyone would find out about it or would use it against him. And at the same time, he championed this art that the Nazis hated. And yet he ended up compromising all his beliefs and in the process in his integrity in order to make progress and advance in the regime, and perhaps also to keep himself and his family safe.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So at what point did Hildebrand Gurlitt start hoarding the stuff personally? Was he like stealing from the Nazis now?
I wouldn't say stealing, but he was buying. I mean, he was buying art from everyone. He was buying from collectors in Germany, from the museums. He bought from the museums, for example, he bought a lot of the art that they could no longer exhibit, so the degenerate art. From the Jews who were escaping, he bought whatever they had to sell, and some of it he sold on, and some of it he kept for himself. In France, he bought a lot from dealers in France. It's a strange thing to imagine, but the art market was actually booming in Paris during the war, partly because so many of the Nazi bigwigs wanted to acquire special pieces for their collections, and it was a way of gaining status. So the art market was extremely buoyant during the Second World War. There was also a shortage of other things to spend money on, of course, because people, you know, couldn't go to the theatre because they were all closed. There was no fine food because it couldn't get there. So, you know, art was one of the things that you could still spend money on. And Hildebrand Gurlitt took full advantage of the buoyant art market in Paris. And in addition to that, the Germans, of course, had manipulated the currency so that their Reichsmarks went a very long way in occupied France. It was a sort of refined form of plunder, if you like. And he bought from private collectors, from dealers, and at auctions in France. And some of it he kept for himself. Much of it he sold on to the Führer Museum and to other museums in Germany. But some of it he kept for himself. And he began to acquire this very, very impressive collection. He also bought some of the degenerate art that had been put in this wheat silo in Berlin and kept it for himself. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when he realized the threat of the Second World War and the fact that his villa in Dresden could be bombed at any point. He'd had to move from Hamburg already because of the bombings. His apartment in Hamburg had been bombed. So he moved to Dresden, and he stashed a lot of the artwork out in little places in the sticks that no one would think of looking, like in the basement of a castle, in an old smithy, in a farm, all of these places, so that when the Allies did conduct their devastating bomb attack on Dresden in February 1945, most of his collection remained intact.
Because he had the sense, or whatever it is, to the cunning to not keep it in his apartment.
Yeah, the foresight, definitely, yeah, the foresight to stash it away. And then, before the end of the war, he escaped to the West, and he managed to take some of his collection with him, and he put it in an old castle in Aschbach, in Bavaria, and he had 47 crates of treasures there. Some of it was books, but a lot of it was artworks. And some of it was seized by the Monuments Men, whom you mentioned earlier on in the context of George Clooney's film. And they seized it and they put it into their collecting point in Wiesbaden. And it took a very long time before he got it back. But he did end up getting most of it back.
Incredible.
From the Monuments Men in 1951.
Incredible. Okay, so now I want to turn this a little bit into a Detroit angle over here. You mentioned that Hildebrandt Gurlitt sold many paintings around the world, actually, and it's come to light that the Detroit Institute of Art, which is a very prominent museum. It may have been that Wilhelm Valentiner, who was the director at that time, is actually went and there was like some sort of an auction or something in New York and picked up for a song a lot of this Expressionist art. The German Expressionist art collection in Detroit is quite extensive. They have a lot of stuff on display all the time, and they have a lot of stuff in storage, which comes out just periodically. So now, just in your assessment of it, there's a story this week that the Museum of Modern Art finally gave back a painting to somebody who said this was our painting. So where should we be going? What's going to be happening with all of this stuff now? There's 1,200 or so pieces of art sitting in an apartment in Germany. We've got museums all over the world that have paintings that, technically speaking, don't belong to them, which are worth at this point probably several billions of dollars. So where should we be going with all this, Catherine Hickley?
Well, the first thing I'd say, I think it's very important to differentiate between the art that the Nazis seized from their own museums and stashed first of all in this wheat silo in Berlin, and then had the likes of Hildebrand Gurlitt sell around the world. Many of these artworks ended up in some of the great museums of the world. And the German museums, which originally possessed them, have absolutely no right by law to claim them back. And this is because the 1938 law, which Goebbels passed in order to legitimize this whole seizure from the museums, has never been repealed. So if the Detroit Museum or any of these other museums bought art that was directly sold by one of the dealers who was responsible for selling the degenerate art that was in German museums, they have nothing to fear. However, of course, many Jewish collectors also collected the degenerate art, the modern art. They collected all kinds of art, and there were many absolutely incredible Jewish collections in Germany before the Second World War. This is exactly the case with the MoMA painting that you just mentioned. I think it was a Franz Marc that had to be returned to the Fischer family. And the reason for that was that it was clearly expropriated from a Jewish collector. And there will be others like this. And a lot of the Jewish dealers fled to the United States before the outbreak of World War II. It was a lot harder for anyone to flee to the United States after the outbreak of World War II. And they started up their businesses there, and they had the contacts in Germany. So in many cases, they were also dealing in art that was sold under duress or sold in forced sales. And there are many dubious acquisitions that found their way to the US, and many of them have already been the case of lawsuits in America. So, the question of where does it all end? Well, I don't think that we can actually see an end in sight at the moment. I mean, the thing is with art, that's a very easy thing to hide away, as we see with Cornelius Gurlitt. He could keep these 1,500 artworks in his home. It's not like real estate. I mean, a Jewish family who lost their home knows exactly where it was, and they could go back and negotiate compensation or some kind of deal with the German government. And that was a lot easier. Problem with artworks is that so many were also destroyed in the Second World War that in many cases we don't know whether missing artworks were destroyed or whether they were stolen, and whether they're still in an attic somewhere or in a basement somewhere or hanging on a museum wall somewhere. It's not even obvious to find that in every case. So there are very many reasons not to set any kind of deadline for the restitution of Nazi looted art and to give claimants an open-ended schedule, really, for finding their property, because so much is still missing.
It seems like we really, even though it's 70 years, it seems like as far as the restitution, returning art to rightful owners, it seems like we're just beginning. Would you say that's correct, Catherine Hickley?
I'd say, well, just beginning is perhaps a little bit too much, but it's only been the last 20 years. And when you consider how many hundreds of thousands of artworks were lost before and during the Second World War, we are just scratching the surface, yes. I mean, it's really still just the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, the fact is that these things will continue to come up. I think often it's a different generation. There are maybe many German families like the Gurlitts who have stolen art in their attics, and they know that it's not really kind of completely legitimate, and they don't really know what to do with it. And then, say, the grandparents die and their children take over, and they're the ones who say, well, let's make a clean slate of this and let's find out whom it really belongs to and let's do the research. So, and not only in Germany, I mean, really everywhere that's possible. So I think that this can, you know, this can take a very, very long time to sort out.
Mm-hmm. I have one time for one final question. This is sort of like a business idea. Let's say that all of the Nazi hoarded of art is suddenly released on the market. I mean, The Lady in Gold went for auction at $127 million. The Kirchner, which the MoMA released, was worth for $30 million. So suddenly, if we have all of these paintings, is that going to affect the value of these art pieces, Catherine?
Well, if all of this stuff comes on the market at the same time, it definitely would. I mean, the thing is, these are, you know, we've seen, I mean, for example, The Woman in Gold was really a one-off piece. You know, that was, it's an absolutely fantastic painting that would always be worth more than $100 million or whatever. And, you know, those kind of artworks just don't come up for auction very often of that caliber, because most of them are already in museums. So it's difficult to say. I mean, the Gurlitt hoard was certainly extremely valuable, but that's going to the Kunstmuseum in Bern. So that will also end up being in a museum, hopefully, as if there's still a dispute over the will. But it looks as though the museum will inherit eventually. It might take some time. So I think, you know, it's very speculative to say what would happen if it was all sold at the same time, because that's definitely not going to happen. Okay. And the artworks that are rediscovered, you know, when they do go for auction, it's an event if it's something like, you know, the Klimts.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Wow, this has been incredible. I want to thank you so much, Catherine, for coming on. Again, our guest has been Catherine Hickley. The book that she has written, has authored, is The Munich Art Hoard, The Hitler's Dealer and His Secret Legacy. It's published by Thames and Hudson. We want to thank you so much for coming on, Catherine.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Okay, take care. We'll be in touch. Okay, that was Catherine Hickley again, The Munich Art Hoard, available Thames and Hudson. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Some things are better the way they used to be, like the crisp feel of a cool autumn day, the serenity of a baby sleeping, or the feeling of coming home after a long trip. Franklin Cider Mills makes cider the way cider is supposed to be. Its old-fashioned, clear, crisp taste reminds you of a cool autumn day. Located in the heart of historic Franklin Village at 14 Mile and Franklin Road, Franklin Cider Mill has been making cider the same way for over a century. Always fresh, with no additives or preservatives. You just can't buy Franklin Cider in any supermarket. Franklin Cider Mill is open from Labor Day weekend to after Thanksgiving from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Come visit Franklin Cider Mill. It's kind of like coming home.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Today is the last day to get Franklin Cider in the year 2015. As soon as the show is over, at 1 o'clock, drop whatever it was that you were doing, wherever you were headed, turn around and go, or maybe you don't even have to turn around, go to 14 Mile and Franklin Road in historic downtown Franklin Village. You'll park there, you'll get out of your car, and you'll buy enough Franklin cider to last you until next September. We put it in the freezer at the Finman home. We enjoy it a whole year. It is definitely a thing to do. We like talking about them, and it's too bad that this is it. This is the last day. Today's the best day to get it, too. This is the best cider of the whole year. It's the last day that it's made. Coming up this week, Yitzhak Perlman will be honored by the U.S. federal government. He'll be presented, actually, the Medal of Honor, which is the highest honor that can be bestowed upon a civilian for all the wonderful things that he's done in educating people about music and culture. And it's also his 70th birthday. I think his 70th birthday was already, but that's why they're giving it to him now, because he's just hit that milestone birthday. So for your listening pleasure, this is Yitzhak Perlman with the Andy Statman Trio playing the Flatbush Waltz. Congratulations, Mr. Perlman. Thank you.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Hey, Shulfin, you're listening to the Jewish Hour. This is brand new. This is Ellie Marcus of Eighth Day. Did a song together with Blue Melody, that prolific instrumental group. The song is called Chavivi, which means my beloved. Let's listen. Someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Barry Schulfman, who you're listening to the Jewish Hour. Famous Bible story. This is probably like number two or three down there somewhere. Probably not for sure in the top five. Joseph and his brothers, the dream coat. They made a whole play out of it with Donny Eisman. Is he still doing Joseph and the dream coat? Yeah, anyway, so he's still playing a 17-year-old. As we say, God bless him. If he can get away with it, go for it. Anyway, so we know everybody knows the story. There's this animosity, and Joseph had dreams, and they sold him into slavery, and he became viceroy, and he brought Jacob down, and they all lived happily ever after until they actually had to be like enslaved in the book of Exodus, which is coming up in a bunch of weeks. Let's look at the dream. Nothing is for no reason. That's all there is. The only thing that has no reason is nothing. Everything has a reason. So we have, Joseph has two dreams. He dreams that he's bundling wheat, and his brothers are bundling wheat, and they put the wheat down, and all of their bundles bow down to his bundle. That's one dream. And then he has another dream that the stars and the sun and the moon are all bowing down to him. And that signifies that not only is it the brothers, but also Jacob and his stepmother, Bilhah, who is like the surrogate mom since Rachel passed away. If the dream was merely to tell the brothers that Joseph was going to be the king, it would have been enough just to have the second dream. And everybody was bowing down to him, including his father. What do we need the sheaf dream all for about? Bundling wheat, you know. So what's the deal with wheat? Wheat grows as an individual stalk. The idea of bundling wheat together is we have to cut the wheat down, because you can't eat wheat when it's growing on a stalk. You have to cut it down. The beginning part of the purification process, of the elevating it, turning it into something usable, and thus by making the world a better place, comes with the bundling. So when we're in the middle of our service to God, and we need to be fulfilling God's mission and making the world a better place, so we should know we're not doing it alone. There is a focal point. There is, say, what we refer to as a Rebbe, somebody, a leader, like a Joseph, who we can turn to for inspiration in how to go about making the world a better place. That's the wheat business. So we're doing that our whole lives, right? At some point, it could very well be that a person is going to achieve a monicum of success in making the world a better place. That he's no longer looking at the physical world as just a place where to throw his bodily desires, but understands that everything in the world is for a holy purpose. And that's his whole raison d'etre. He wakes up in the morning to make the world a better place. So at this point, we tell the person, you have to look at the stars. Okay, they're out there. But it's all one thing again. It's like, again, looking up, achieving a higher and greater level. But what were those stars doing? The stars, the sun, the moon? They're bowing down to that same Yosef. So even though a person may be successful in what it is that they're doing, there's always that little bit of success that could be a little bit more on a higher and deeper level. And for that, we need to turn to the source of inspiration. Where do we find that inspiration today? Well, we got the five books of Moses. We have the Bible. We have Judaism. Drop me a letter and I'll discuss it more at rabbifinman.com. But we're running out of time. We got to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Easiest way? RabbiFinman.com. RabbiFinman.com. Right there on the homepage, we have the contact us, sends an email right to my email box, my inbox, and I get it. And now that we have the advent of smartphones, I'm getting it pretty much instantaneously. So the return rate has just like, I don't have to even wait to get to the computer. It's like right in my pocket. So, and we communicate and we become good buddies. You'll also find archive editions of the show. You find classes of mine, which are posted there. The E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic Youth Story, which are inspirational words culled from the Torah portion of the week, stories and things like that, in modes other than just listening, which presented by yours truly, hopefully in an entertaining and educational way. There's also the very important donations page. We're the end of November. We haven't paid November. They would like us to pay November. We can't pay November because somebody out there didn't go, you know who you are, did not go to the computer to go to RabbiFinman.com, go on the donations page, and make a donation. It's quick, it's easy, it's harmless. The end of the year is coming up. It's tax deductible. You can take it right off your taxes. Ask your accountant, how do you do that? I'm not an accountant. But do it. Don't like using internet for credit card things or PayPal, that kind of stuff? I understand. Send your donation in any amount. I mean any amount. If everybody listening were to send a dollar a week, then I wouldn't have to do this. I could spend like this 3 minutes doing something more educational than, you know, doing the spiel about money. So do it for yourself. You enjoy listening to the show. How do I know? Because you're listening. You listened all the way to this point. Send your donation of any amount, if you're mailing it, to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Sometime in the 50s, 1950s, there was a couple living in Detroit that were having problems having children. They went to doctors. I mean, fertility specialists back then were like, yeah, hello. And they weren't having any kids. Not a Lubavitch family, not a Lubavitch couple, but this rabbi was learning with a Lubavitcher who lived in town at the time. And he was telling him that he's having problems with his wife. This Lubavitcher suggested, why don't you get an audience with the Lubavitcher Rebbe? And so they did. A certain time, they were told, come at midnight. Okay? The Rebbe's audiences start at, private audiences started at 8 p.m. So they were told, come at midnight. You're like in the third wave. By the time they actually got into the Rebbe's office, it was 2:45. So they presented his, a little piece of paper, presented what he was there for. And the Rebbe asked, did you have this test? And they said, we had this test twice. And he said, that's such an intrusive, painful test. Why twice? And he said, well, the doctors wanted it. So he says, no, from now on, if you're going to do anything, just leave it to blood work. Don't do that test anymore. That's like a dangerous thing. Then he said, you were married. You were engaged once before. And he gave the girl a ring, right? He said, yeah. He said, did you ever ask her for her forgiveness once you broke it up? And he said, no, I didn't think about it. He said, this is what you got to do. You have to make some kind of connection with your former fiance. Ask her forgiveness. So he said, how do I know she's going to forgive me? So he said, tell the woman that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, this woman was a Lubavitcher, promises that she will get engaged if she forgives you. So went out, he spoke to the brother-in-law, who could have been the brother-in-law, and the woman forgave him and said, yeah, it's okay, you can be married to this woman. 3 weeks later, the former fiancé got engaged. Before they were married, this man's woman became pregnant. He had a flock of kids. He's now a great-grandfather living in Detroit still. That's going to do it. And thank you so much for tuning in. Next week's the first Hanukkah show of the year. So come back next week. Thanks.
Make a cup of rain.